Welcome to Photo Geek Weekly, episode 65, recorded on April 18th, 2019. And, you know, this is probably my favorite hour of the week, to sit down with a fellow photographer and just geek out about the industry's news as far down as we can dig into the topics of the week. And, you know, one of my favorite guests, and in fact, the only one that has knowingly showed me detailed notes on the stories that we talk about on a weekly basis. He is an IT professional. He's a rock jock and a concert photographer. You know him because he's the most popular guest on this podcast. Welcome back to the show, Steve Brazel.
How are you, my friend? Good to see you.
I am great. It feels like I should have been recording the banter in the pre-roll because we had a great conversation about many things that I'm sure the audience would enjoy that is not topical to a news story. Maybe we'll have to just have a back and forth discussion one of these days.
But that's why people need to tell their friends about the show, because really, I did it before I was on your show and I listened. It's an opportunity to just sit and talk back to your headphones or whatever it is. You can be involved in the conversation, because really what we did before you started the, you know, camera rolling, as it were, was just what every photographer does when they find a topic that they want to geek out about, and that is just banter and banter and banter.
You know, my favorite thing about going on photo walks is the glass of beer afterwards and just discussing with photographers just whatever we could get a few words in edgewise on the walk, and then just kind of, cry your heart out on the latest and greatest equipment that you can't afford, or your opinions on this, that, and the other. And that's what we're here to do, right?
Yep.
All right. So, Steve, I know that you've had some interesting guests on your podcast, and I want to just touch on that really quickly right away, including me.
You are, as at the time we record this, you are the current guest. You are hands down, based on downloads and views of the podcast, you're hands down far away ahead, the most popular guest I have on Behind the Shot. But I've had, you know, coming out soon after we recorded this, I've got Colin Smith on doing a drone photo of Colin Smith of Photoshop Cafe. And then I've got Kelly Robitaille on. I just had Renee Robin on. I've got Rick Salmon coming back on. And I've got a really unusual, rare one. Scott Bourne always jokes that he doesn't do video. He's got a face for radio. But I was on his new podcast, and he has agreed to come on Behind the Shot as well. And we're going to record that at the end of May.
That's awesome. So many great guests you have lined up. And Kelly Robitaille is from my hometown of Sudbury, Ontario.
Yeah.
Which is kind of an interesting connection there.
I've never met her, artist. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And I taken a look at some of her work when you mentioned her name. And I'm really looking forward to that discussion, as I am many of them. But I actually enjoy the conversations that are so far afield from what I do, because I have no preconceptions as to what creative process somebody might be going through. And I can just kind of sit back, blank slate, and be a sponge to that. And your podcast is a great way to provide that.
Thank you very much.
Well, and you mentioned that I'm your current guest. If anybody wants to tune into that, we talk about my image, Essence of Reverie. Reverie is kind of a word synonymous with daydreaming. And this is a water droplet refraction image. It's actually my best-selling water droplet photograph.
It's behind you in the video I'm looking at, which you don't
record. Yeah, we don't record the video, right, but now, but I do have one behind me. It's actually a customer that's going to be picking it up when they attend a workshop in the next little while. And, you know, it's fun to talk about how that image is created, not just because of the technical aspects, but just the creative process that goes into that. And it's hard for me as a professional to show this work and really get across the amount of time it takes to tinker and just experiment and make mistakes. Don't call them mistakes. Stepping stones towards whatever your success is going to be, which you don't even know what that's going to be when you start out on that process.
Well, and the fascinating thing to me, your shot, the Essence of Reverie, but also kind of all the shots, there are times that you discuss in detail where you dissect an image with the maker of that image, right? That you find a different scale to what you shoot. In your case, it's a physical scale. I see this shot, this water droplet refraction, and I had no concept of just how small that was in real life compared to when it's, you know, a 20 by 24 print. And it's the same thing with all photography. Sometimes you just see how a photographer works, how they see their post-processing, how they pre-visualize, and the scale, mental scale that they put in to creating their vision is fascinating to me.
And, you know, it's funny because I do workshops on this. I did one just this past weekend, and I've got a classroom that was filled with 8 students, every one of them very well equipped, not just with the equipment, but with the mental fortitude to understand, you know, how the different ingredients connect together like puzzle pieces. And if you put them together the wrong way, then it doesn't look like the way that you want it to be. And I've got more of those workshops coming up through the year, by the way, if anybody wants to check them out. Shameless plug, it's my podcast. I can do that at doncom.ca/workshop. Where I also have an Iceland workshop that I need to fill up. I need 5 more spots on that. And we go to the most beautiful waterfalls, that iconic plane wreck, and so many wonderful places at the end of October, hopefully with tons of opportunity to see the Northern Lights. But my point is, it's best to see a professional at work, or an expert in any field, hands-on. I mean, you can talk to them about it. You can watch them from a distance. But if you're hands-on and right there, it's far and away the best possible experience. Your podcast, I think, is second best because we can't always be looking over everybody's shoulder. But Steve, let's get into some of the stories here, because but before we do, though, there's one that's not on our docket that I think photography has had a very strong impact on a global scale in this past week. And that is the fire at the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris.
Yep.
And this, I mean, it caught everybody's radar because it's been everywhere on the news and in social media. And one of the reasons why it has been in social media is because everybody is equipped effectively as a photojournalist these days. And it's tragic. And I'm thrilled that it was contained. And I heard something like 90% of the art and artifacts have been saved.
Yes. And because some of them had been removed for the remodeling and renovations they were doing.
And some of them were actively being removed while the structure was ablaze, from what I understand. And, you know, brave people. And, you know, I applaud you for everything that you did. But, you know, you had all the bystanders taking video and photos and sharing that with the rest of the world instantaneously to see all of that happen. And you know, I don't know how much of that footage was recorded on our traditional kind of cameras, you know, whether it be mirrorless or flapping mirrors or whatever, but a dedicated camera device versus a smartphone. And I think that by and large, the phrase, you know, the best camera is the one that you have with you. And I forget who said that. I don't want to misattribute it, but the concept is that you can pull out your phone and it is now an exceptional camera, especially when it needs to be. But it's so good that I think that there is a generation younger than both of us that will rely solely on their smartphone as a device for picture taking. And they might even judge their next purchase based on the quality of the camera and the quality of the apps associated with it, either being iOS or Android, and what's available to their to help their creativity within that single solitary device, right?
Oh, yeah. And the thing is, it's not just the best camera is the one that you have with you. The most important camera you ever have is the one that's easily accessible, even if you have two. It's the one you can pull up and get a shot off quickly. That's where citizen journalism comes into play. And we've seen it with everything from police videos to, you know, citizens watching police do a job, to things like Notre Dame. And I think it's going to be interesting 10, 15, 20 years from now, when the cameras that are in mobile devices like phones are so good, partially through photography AI, that's the only thing many people will know, and they will be able to grab something out of their purse or pocket and take extremely amazing footage from wherever they are, so that now the news feed will be real time at all times.
Well, and I mean, we talk about small attention spans with people these days. I mean, you'd just be jumping across from news story to news story. It doesn't matter if it's happening in Paris or Lithuania or the outback of Australia. There would be something happening anywhere in the world worth tuning into. And I think we're just kind of on the cusp of that. But I kind of wanted to bring this as a bit of a segue into our first story. which one of the shortfalls of most smartphones is their ability to light a scene themselves. I mean, yes, you'll have a small little either LED, or some smartphones have had tiny little xenon flashes. I think one of the Nokias had one, but they're worse than a pop-up flash on a point-and-shoot camera in terms of the quality of the light that they provide. And while AI might improve that to some degree over the ensuing years, it's still not going to replace the artistry of actually being able to control light now with an off-camera speed light like you would be able to from a traditional camera. Enter LIT. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. LIT is the acronym. And this has been widely reported. I pulled up an article here from DP Review, but I also have their media kit and their press release. It is a wireless xenon flash for your smartphone. And this, I think, could be a useful tool for those people that are never even considering to buy a traditional camera. And like I said, there's an entire generation of people that might qualify for because it is, you know, what's in your pocket is all you'd need. Maybe you've got an action camera as well, but it's not nearly as versatile as the phone that you have that you do most of your work that's connected and that you could share instantly because you have that instant gratification. So, Steve, I know you've got a little bit of a rundown of some of the features that this thing has, and it looks like a fairly robust device that is currently being funded on Kickstarter.
Yeah, and I want to mention, this is from the same people. If you've seen the light meters that plug into your phone, like they plug into the lightning port on an iPhone, and it's a light meter that does not just ambient light or flashlight output, but also can test color and things like that. They're fairly advanced with what they're doing. It's the people who do the Lumu light meter. And they're doing this on Kickstarter. As you mentioned, it's xenon. It's not LED. But they,
Steve, why is that important?
Well, brightness, for one. This thing is the size of a phone almost. So instead of that little LED on your phone, but, well, you're the real engineer geek. So give us a xenon lesson.
Okay. So it has to do with duration of the flash. So LEDs, and I encounter this a lot with ring flashes. When people buy an inexpensive ring flash for macro photography, they're almost always, there are exceptions, and I always make note of them, they're almost always LED-based. And one of the problems with macro photography that this comes into is flash duration. Because if you have a little bit of motion blur and your flash isn't fast enough, that motion blur is still retained in the photograph.
Right.
And so you'll often see macro or any LED-based flash state that you have to use a slower sync speed than what your regular sync speed would be. Let's say your regular sync speed is 1/200th or 250th of a second. An LED light might say, well, we can only sync at 1/120th or 1/60th of a second.
Whereas this light will do 1/10,000th.
Well, that's high-speed sync, and that's a different thing. But the point here is it has that longer duration because it has to be exposed for a much longer time. I'll give you a hypothetical scenario here. Let's say you're in a completely dark room, like not a stray photon of light.
Okay.
And you leave the camera open, the shutter open for 10 minutes. And arbitrarily during that time, you pop a flash. What is the length of that exposure? Is it 10 minutes or is it the duration of the flash? The one we care about is the duration of the flash. So when you're talking about LEDs, that flash duration might be 1/200th of a second, maybe 1/100th of a second or something in that neighborhood, which is fine if you're doing portrait, but definitely not for any action scene or anything that might have significant motion in it. But a xenon flash tube at its lowest power settings can often reach 1/20,000th of a second. And in this case, this flash has a 1/256 power setting that you can get to, which brings that down to a flash duration of 1/30,000th of a second from that singular pulse. And that means that you don't have motion blur in your scenes. If you want to use a device like this to have like a snowboarder or a skateboarder like overhead and one of your other buddies is holding the light and you're underneath with your smartphone and you're using a flash like this to completely freeze that scene, you would have no chance of doing that with an LED-based product. You would need to have a xenon-based product that has a very, very short flash duration.
So take that in combination with the fact that it's a 40-watt light, you can do some amazing stuff with this.
Yeah, 40 watt second. So that's a guide number of around 32. You'd be looking at like a mid-range speed light. I mean, you wouldn't be flagship.
Like a high-end speed light's usually 60 to 80.
Right. And sometimes it can go beyond that, depending if you're in studio strobes, of course. That's always going to be a different case. But so if you're looking at like a Canon 430, I don't know if they're still making the 430 series.
Yeah, 430 EX2.
Yeah, it'd probably be equivalent to that, which is more than you would need for most of your mobile photography. And even if you were using it at maximum output, now keep in mind that that 1/30,000th of a second is at your minimum output speed, that or output power at 1/250th, or yeah,
256.
But if you're at the full on 1:1, that that power is going to be less. It's only going to be at 1/350th of a second. But that's, you're not going to need that for every scenario. That's not going to be your close-up action scene. That's going to be something of a distance. You're lighting up a landscape or something for that matter. And so to each their own, they will find their uses.
Well, and again, one of the big problems even with standard flashes and speed lights is battery power. This thing has a 2800 milliamp battery built into it that you charge over USB-C that will give you 200 full power flashes with a recycle time of, what was it, 0.1 to 2.5 seconds, depending, you know, on how full the battery is. That really means you could take this thing out with your phone for a full shoot and probably get some really creative work out of it.
And 400 flashes in real life usage, because you're not going to be at full power for every shot.
Exactly.
And so, yeah, you'd be able to get some pretty interesting, life out of this on a single charge without needing to have a second one.
Well, and here's where it gets interesting. And then other companies have done this. LumCube does this with their app. You can control more than one flash at a time. So you can do a multi-light portrait session with two lights, three lights, up to four lights. You could really create some really cool stuff here. Here's the downside to me of this flash. Now, I reached out to one of the founders, a guy by the name of Marco, and you have to use their app for this. And he sent screenshots of the app because it's not out yet. The device is not public yet. They only have prototypes. But one of the things I said to him was, okay, I've got to use your app. I'm not clear. If I'm going to use your app and I've got all this great flash capability, does your app shoot RAW? Yes, it does. It shoots DNG, so that's great. But it's Bluetooth 5.0. It's not Wi-Fi. Right. They're saying it's got a range of 130 feet. I would find it hard-pressed to believe that on Bluetooth, even Bluetooth 5, that you're going to get 130 feet in a real-world environment.
Well, because you're going to have radio interference all over the place, no matter where you are. But even still, that's a greater distance than I would be mounting a flash from my camera to begin with.
Normally, but it's hard to say. If you want to get really creative, I could see somebody wanting to use this at 60 feet, 50 feet, and I want to see, will it work like that?
Well, and I don't know if that's necessarily the product for that, nor would it necessarily be the product to have like more than two of them running at the same time. Because you have to remember, this is for the smartphone photographer. And if you want to do high-end portraiture, then there is a load of equipment for professional photographers that can hit every single checkbox down the way. Yeah. But it comes down to cost, right? So you look at how much this thing costs. What is the MSRP versus the Kickstarter?
Yeah, retail is $329.
You really want to buy four of them at that price, Steve.
And now on Kickstarter, you save $150. It's $179 right now on Kickstarter. But yeah, it's a $329 retail price, which is, you know, crazy to say the least. But, you know, picture one of these or two of these with a smartphone. Think about how many people are out there using moment lenses, right? Or high-end smartphone lenses, telephoto, wide angle. I think you could get really creative. I do think the cost, this costs basically what a small speed light would cost.
But I think that the cost is necessary to give the product that people want. I don't think that you could have the robust product specifications that we're seeing at a lower price. I mean, another company might make a cheaper one, but it's not going to be as good as this.
Or have the features of this. There's two features that I kind of read it when I read it on the article. I kind of had to read it again. It's got a stroboscopic mode. So now you can do stroboscopic pictures with a smartphone. That's kind of cool.
Cool.
And it also has a remote trigger. So you could theoretically put your phone on a monopod or a tripod or lean it against something, go however they say 130 feet away, and trigger the camera from the flash.
That I think is really cool. And they've found other ways to take that exact same connectivity. And they call it the My Precious setting. And so when you turn that on, the app will notify you if your flash gets out of reach, if you leave it somewhere.
Right.
If it gets too far away.
Again,
or vice versa. If you have the flash on you, but your phone is too far away, then it will make your phone ring even if it's on silent. So it has that, don't leave one device behind kind of mentality. And that, that's compatible with the iPhone, back to the iPhone 7. Interestingly, not the iPhone 6S, because that did support RAW as well. Maybe it has something to do with other functionality and connectivity.
It could be the Bluetooth version.
Yeah.
My question for you. It's not out yet. I think it was end of the year, or was it beginning of next year? I think it's January of 2020 that it's coming.
That's right.
They already have accessories planned. And the first thought that hit me was, why are you listing them as planned? If you're doing a deal right now where you're taking Kickstarter orders on this flash, these accessories aren't difficult. They should be available at launch. And it doesn't sound like they will be. They're going to have a dome diffuser. That's kind of cool. Color filters and even a grid.
Well, diffuser is just like formed plastic. I mean, that doesn't seem like it's going to be terribly difficult.
Color filters or a disc of plastic. I don't understand why those are planned accessories, not at launch. But here's my big question for you. Did you look at the Flickr gallery?
I did. It seemed...
one consistent thing in those pictures that kind of bugged me.
Okay, what is it?
A number of them were overexposed.
Yes, but they were also like some were backlit, and so the overexposure in certain areas might have been intentional.
No. Again, some of the pictures were fine, and I liked them. There were two skateboard pictures. One of them was fine. The other one was the flash was too close to the guy, or the power was too high. And if these are your marketing pictures, there were a couple portraits where the skin was blown out. I'm just thinking the pictures were hot. A number of the pictures that were front lit were too hot, which I found interesting. I'm not saying that makes the product bad. Don't misunderstand me. If somebody from the company hears this, this product is really intriguing to me. But really, honestly, some of the pictures were too hot.
Well, and it says that the exposure control has auto through TTL and then creative modes and manual. So creative modes would be that stroboscopic effect and others.
Right.
But TTL on a smartphone is not a consistent thing, especially if you're going to make it compatible with iPhone and Android. They haven't announced exactly what products are available there yet, because every camera is going to be different. They're made by different people. They have different lenses and different quality factors. So TTL might be something a bit tricky to get used to. And you might have to kind of hone in on how to offset that a little bit on your particular device.
But they're your own marketing shots.
Well, but here's the problem, though. No, Steve, and this is true of many other Kickstarter campaigns that I have seen, is that the marketing shots are not made by the best professionals within the class. Within that genre of photography, they should be, but this is not the only case where they have not been. In fact, most of the cases when you have, lighting equipment or you have like gimmicky proof of concept images that are used to sell the product, and it works. Because you see the Kickstarter campaigns or Indiegogo, crowdfunding in general, they will be vastly overfunded, even with lenses. You see, like when Meyer Optic was doing all their, much maligned crowdfunding campaigns for their lenses, some of the examples were yawn inspiring. I mean, they were not,
That's my point. I don't get that. To me, and here's the reason I even bring that up, right? I mean, it's like, okay, so their pictures are a little hot for me, whatever. But here's the reason I bring it up. As a product category, this is very intriguing to me. I like external lenses on my phone. I like the idea, and I use my phone flash periodically when somebody else is taking a picture. They're using an on-camera flash. I'll go, hold on, and I'll turn my flashlight on and light creatively. I find this category and how well this looks to be built, very, very intriguing. And then you put out pictures to me that some of them were fantastic. Some of them didn't speak well to your product. I kind of wish that they all did to reinforce what looks like an amazing product to me.
Yeah, well, and one of them shows, sort of a lifestyle photo of somebody sticking this thing in their back pocket. But right. The actual flash lens it wouldn't fit in any normal person's pocket. And if you were to sit down on that thing, you would break it. Don't put that in your pocket.
Yeah, unless they're trying to say it's durable enough for that. But you see my point. Would you want to try one of these?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I don't do a lot of complex and orchestrated work with my smartphone. It's usually documentary work. I'm taking a picture of a price at the supermarket, or I'm taking a behind the scenes photograph, or of course I'm a bit of an anachronism. I've got the red hydrogen, which can capture 3D images. And sometimes that's a useful thing to do, because my regular camera, on the fly can't do that. But, in this scenario, I mean, would this change the way that I look at photography? For me, no, but I don't think I am the target audience for this. You're more the target.
You're not the demo they're going for.
No, appreciate that. And I appreciate that the demo that they are creating this for is going to be drooling over it.
You know, they put skateboarders in their ads for a reason.
Exactly.
Kids that are down there skateboarding in a skate park or on the street, or I can imagine people doing, Ninja Warrior type stuff running around, you know, the city. Jumping buildings and stairs. You could get some amazing stuff. Put one of these as somebody jumps over a ledge, have it shoot up, but you shoot it from
forward. Parkour audience would really like this. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you could do some amazing stuff with this.
All right. Well, I think we've talked that one to death. They're doing really well in their campaign so far. I don't think that they've hit their funding goal. At least they didn't when I was pulling up this initially. But if I were to, in real-time statistics, bring this up to show you where their numbers
are, they met their goal.
We're talking about it.
They're $888 over their goal. Awesome. Congratulations.
Just passed it. Congratulations. So that's fantastic. And they still have 27 days to go, as we recorded this, of a 30-day campaign. So 10% of the time in to reach 100% of their goal. Let's hope that they vastly exceed what their goal was, because one of the worst things that I see in Kickstarter campaigns is when they just barely meet their goal. And now they're committed to produce a product that has so many overages in production costs that it just doesn't materialize. And that's happened so many times. So if you're interested in this product with 90% of the time left still to go and they've hit their goal, I think this might be a pretty safe bet, as far along as they are, that this will materialize into something good.
Well, and again, they have a track record. Their light meter for smartphones is actually pretty interesting as well. So it's a company I would trust to deliver on the product. I'm actually really anxious to get one in a hand.
Perfect. Let's talk about companies I don't trust then, Steve.
Oh, boy.
So, again, widely reported, and as it should be, but this was from Petapixel. I found the article that the 500px owner, which is Visual China Group, VCG, slammed for claiming copyright to the black hole image, which we talked about in the last episode of Photo Geek Weekly, which has been maligned by those same millennials that might love that lit flash because the resolution isn't there. But hey, come on, this is the cutting edge of science and it's an impossible image that has become possible. We should be celebrating this. Temples and shrines to bow down to a photograph of this accomplishment. But nobody owns it. It's public domain. Right, NASA and most of the European Space Agency work and space agencies around the world, for the most part, put their work in the public domain, as far as I know.
This technically is actually not public domain. It's Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International. It does have restrictions and requirements on it.
That is true. I shouldn't say specifically public domain. Thank you for correcting me. Within those attributions and the international, are you familiar with all of the different sects of the Creative Commons designations?
Oh, no. There's so many of them. But the one that this one is, I actually didn't know that there were some that had the word international in them. But the Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International, which is the one this one is, has three specific sections that you deal with. You are allowed to share it, meaning copy, redistribute the material in any medium or format. You are allowed to adapt it, meaning you can remix it, transform it, build upon the material, even commercially. But you must give appropriate credit.
Yes.
Provide a link to the license and indicate, this was an interesting one to me, you can make changes, but if you did, you actually have to indicate that you made those changes.
I think that's very useful for an image that has scientific integrity in its
unedited form. Totally agree.
Yeah. Yeah. And no additional restrictions beyond that. I mean, that's as far as they go. But okay, so VCG has been called the Getty Images of China on many occasions. And I've always found their English website to be really cookie cutter and placeholder and didn't really make a lot of sense when you could get to it, but we'll get to that. They loaded up this image for sale, much like Getty Images does. You know, talking about the Getty Images of China, they are following suit with that same, right. Action
aggressiveness,
plan, I suppose. And if you were to translate some of the communications here, they specifically asked whether the picture belongs to VCG, and a VCG representative stated, matter-of-factly, yes. Just
that they owned yes, the copyright.
That they owned it. And that it needed to be licensed before it could be used, which is a huge
from VCG, that you had to pay for a license from VCG, which is completely false.
Yeah. And then this was the tip of the iceberg, you know, the snowball effect, as people start to do some digging into VCG. And this was, I'm smiling here because it came to be that the Chinese national emblem and national flag was also listed as licensable images on VCG. Now, selling images of the emblem and flag are illegal in China. And China really has their hands in, their fingers go everywhere into every company, especially something as big as VCG that is trading outside of China. And so as I'm going to read from the article here. As the controversy grew, it attracted the attention of Chinese authorities, which issued an order instructing the company to put an end to its, quote, illegal rule-breaking practices. VCG responded by removing all of the offending images it could find and suspended its website operations.
The Getty of China closed temporarily.
And, well, and I've loaded up the website again, and it's still down right now. So, wow, they got their hand caught in the cookie jar. And the Chinese government basically, I mean, just put them in a dark closet and said, don't come out until you're ready.
Yeah. And okay. So first of all, I wasn't on the last episode. So let me just say to the people at the Event Horizon Telescope Collaboration, wow.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Just wow. Amazing work. The entire team, amazing work. And there's been other controversies about this image with people trying to discredit the young lady who created the algorithm over it. These people, to me, are just beyond amazing. But
I want everybody on that team, anybody that looked at the raw data or had any say in it whatsoever, to give themselves a pat on the back. If you had exactly any contribution to this whatsoever, if you did 50% of the work, which nobody did, well, then give yourself a pat on the back and pat everybody else on the back, because nobody could have done this alone. This is not done in a vacuum.
This is literally the definition of a team effort, from my angle at least. So congratulations, first of all, to them. But from a VCG point of view, many people did not know that 500px, which was originally a Canadian company, as I recall.
Just south of me. They were from Toronto.
With Evgeny, was one of the founders, and he ended up selling it. He's now involved in Skylum, and a great, nice guy. I've been on a show with him before. Many people did not know that a Chinese company like VCG, that was a Getty equivalent, owned 500px. And the big takeaway to me from this is, when you have a company like VCG that is willing to claim copyright and have their reps tell people, yes, you must license this image from us, when clearly they don't. They not only did it with the Chinese emblem and national flag, which that's illegal in China where they're from. They also did it for well-known company logos. They actually claimed the copyright and the ability to license company logos. And this is, and you know, they came out, their apology was so weak to me. We failed to do our due diligence in assessment, leading to the appearance of substandard content. We've taken down all non-compliant photos and closed down the site voluntarily for a revamp in accordance with related laws. Okay, whatever. So you now have a company that's willing to, this wasn't not doing their due diligence. They were doing it with things that clearly you don't own.
Look at
everybody knew it.
Look at what comes out of China in terms of flagrant disregard to copyright. I mean, just
and any intellectual property.
Take a browse through Alibaba. You know, and you will find everything. I have found some of my own images printed on sweatshirts, on hoodies. And I actually bought one to see where it would come from, if it was from a pursuable country and it was shipped from Hong Kong or Shenzhen or something like that.
Right.
I was like, okay, I'm not going to go up against copyright in China because that's an impossibility. The only person or the only entity that could really enforce that is the Chinese government themselves.
And they clearly aren't going to. But from a photographer point of view, these are the people who own the very popular 500px.
And I publish on the 500px platform all the time. And I've been saying for a while, what is going to be the final straw?
They used to have a sales area where you could voluntarily put your images in for sale as stock art through 500px. And okay, so now if you did something like that through a 500px, is VCG going to try and claim your copyright and license your images in China without telling you?
Well, without telling you, that's the key, right? Because Sure, I mean, you could say that you're going to license your images and then the report comes back, oh, no, you didn't get any licenses this month. Sorry, better luck next time. Meanwhile, it might have been licensed a dozen times in Asia.
And that's the problem is I'm looking at a company who... This wasn't an accident. Let's be honest. I don't care what they say. This doesn't appear to be an accident. I don't see how this could have been an accident. This image was clearly all around the world as far as the black hole is concerned. They tried to grab copyright on something they knew wasn't. And I question any commitment I would have to 500px now.
Yeah. And I've been questioning that commitment for a long time, and this just gives me more and more questions without any positive answer to it. When this boils over here, when we see VCG come back, what they say when they do will be my deciding factor on whether or not I continue to use the 500px platform. And if I decide not to, I'll post one more photograph basically stating, this is my last image. Here's where else you can find me online. And I've got a following in the thousands there. And I hate to leave a following behind because they comment and they interact. And there's some positivity from that. And I've made some friends that have found me on 500px. But enough's enough. I mean, if that platform is proving itself to be untrustworthy, not just in and amongst itself, but its parent company is VCG, and its reputation is dragged down with that, well, then it's not going to bring itself back up on its own.
Well, and let's be honest. Part of the reason 500px became so popular is because they didn't compress your images to death. You post a picture on 500px, they looked great at a time when Flickr was dying because Yahoo was letting it die and Facebook and Instagram and Twitter compress everything. It was the place to put high quality images. But now we've got Flickr owned by SmugMug, who cares about photography. They're resurrecting that platform. You really have to question now, is 500px still the place?
And that is the question. And again, that the answer to that is going to come when VCG puts its website back up with whatever statement, but maybe they won't. Maybe that is just, okay, China's shutting them down and they just say, we're not coming back. And then 500px, they are just like an orphaned entity then at that point.
Well, here's my question to you then. Okay, they come back. VCG comes back. They make a statement. What are they going to say that's going to make you go, okay, I'm okay with that?
I don't know, because everything I can think of makes me still think negatively. It would have to be something completely out of left field, something so philanthropic and apologetic and giving so much back to the photographic community in ways that I cannot comprehend because I don't even know what they're capable of. But yep. they would have to take a huge hit and sacrifice monetarily in order to make this right.
I agree.
Yeah. Let's talk about spending money on things. Not a lot of money, but it can get you quite a bit. This is Trey Ratcliffe. I'm sure many of us know who Trey is. Famous initially for his work in HDR photography, a pioneer in that area. Created his website Stuck in Customs, and he's done a lot of business. He started the Arcanum, which I was a member of for many years, which is shut down last, about a month or so ago, which I'm still a little bit bitter about that it never really came to the full growth that we all hoped for. But Trey has not been sitting idle. He has written a book on exposing how people can cheat at Instagram. Now, you can't really cheat at a social media network, just like you can't cheat at Christmas dinner. I mean, what are you going to do to cheat at it? But you can get more followers than you legitimately deserve. And
The system is probably a better phrase.
Exactly. And so in this case, I've known, and I'm sure you've seen too, Steve. Have you seen like videos of the inside of click farms and like farms in India yep. and Pakistan and maybe China, Russia, anywhere over there? It's this like massive wall of phones. Each of them loaded up with an Instagram account. Probably they switch accounts periodically that randomly like certain stuff. It's all pre-programmed and it's got some overarching application that guides through Instagram to give it all of these likes and everything. And you just see all these blinking screens pretending to be people. Well, the reason why they're pretending to be people is because people will pay for that. And you can pay to have additional followers on Instagram. If you want to pay, in this article here on Petapixel, it says spending an average of $40 for each 30,000 followers. Ratcliffe racked up 104,000 followers and thousands of likes and comments on the fake account at Gent Travel. And okay, so number one, why did he only spend $100 to get that many?
To get 104,000 followers.
I mean, my Facebook budget, because I do marketing on Facebook and Instagram. I promote my posts there, especially when I'm doing workshops and things like that to get a bigger audience or at least to get that in front of a larger audience. And people will book for those workshops and there's a return on that investment or I will gain legitimate followers. But why should I be doing that when it might cost me $1,000 to get, 4,000 followers when I can spend $40 to get 30,000.
Well, and here's the thing. It's a different market. You're trying to sell you, your product, your workshops. What Trey was trying to show was the inner workings of something like Instagram, where everybody wants to become an influencer. So when you get enough followers, companies in certain demographics may look at you and say, well, this guy's got $104,000. If we can get him to do a post with one of our products in it, that gets us exposure. Now, in reality, it's fake exposure. It's going to 104,000 bots. But those influencers can end up getting paid huge amounts of money, $1,000, $10,000, $100,000. The influencers can be flown to hotels. They get the hotel stay, products, plane tickets, restaurant meals. And really what Trey was trying to do, and by the way, I've interviewed Trey for my podcast and I'm working right now on getting him back on to discuss one of his Burning Man images. He is one of the smartest guys I've ever talked to. He's a very, very intelligent man. And he really wanted to see in an influencer market where it's worth billions of dollars a year, they're saying by 2020, it could be worth $10 billion a year, the influencer market.
So I don't disbelieve that at all.
Oh, no. In fact, the assumption is it was only $2 billion in 2017. So you're talking a 10-time increase five-time increase in 3 years. That's absolutely amazing.
But he wanted to
find out where this would go. And the title of his book, to me, is just brilliant.
And the title
Under the Influence, How to Fake Your Way Into Getting Rich on Instagram, Influencer Fraud, Selfies, Anxiety, Ego, and Mass Delusional Behavior.
That is the human race right there. I mean, there's no changing that. So this is just going to get bigger and worse. But I did pull up the fake account right now. The first time that I had done so, it had around 90,000 followers, which had been gone down considerably from the 104. And now it's at 80,000 followers. So it's not like the bots are leaving. It could be that Instagram has been getting wise to this and is starting to cull accounts based on the followers that he has, based on the publicity of this whole thing. And good for Instagram for at least taking that to some task. I would like to see that number go down even lower, because the number of fake accounts on Instagram is gargantuan. But you can actually tell, and you can judge the quality of an Instagram account. There's a website called igaudit.io. And if you go to igaudit.io, it'll give you a simple dialog box, and it says, enter a public Instagram username. And I'm going to put in mine, doncomphoto, right now. And I'm going to click on search for that. And it's going to find out the average likes that I have. And I've got an average of 1.4 thousand likes, 1,400 likes. And it says the expected is only 335 based on my following. So I'm well above on that. That might be suspicious in some ways. The average comments are, almost 23, but the expected is less than 20. And so it turns out, after it goes through and analyzes a subset of my audience to see if they're real, the estimated real followers on my account is 87.1%. So that's...
Oh, I did better than you. I just ran mine at the same time. I'm at 91%.
Oh, there you go. But if I type in Gent Travel, let's see what Gent Travel has. He's got an average of 7.8 thousand likes. Almost close to 200 comments on every post based on the number of followers that he has. But let's see what happens when this number comes back. It's reading follower data right now. We're looking this up in real time. And I'm curious if you might be running this too, Steve, to see what if our numbers are going to be the same.
I actually just ran behind the shot.
Oh, okay.
Behind the shot TV.
But the estimated real followers for this account is 29.5.
Wow.
So now, if you are going to pay thousands of dollars to an influencer, you're going to make sure that that number of real followers is above 80%, I'm sure. But at the same time, I remember reading an article about somebody that did not get a photo shoot gig. I think it was from Canon or some other big manufacturer. They originally confirmed and then reneged on the deal because the person didn't have 50,000 followers on Instagram. So people lose work when their social media following, when their influencership is not high enough. Now, does that mean you should maybe mix a little bit of the fake in with the good in order to pad your numbers? Well, that makes your estimated real followers go down. And that, I think, could hurt your brand more than it could help for anybody that cares to look. And anybody that's going to be spending thousands or tens of thousands of dollars is going to make these tools available to themselves to make sure that their money is being spent in the right place. Or at least I hope. There might be naive companies out there, especially the smaller fish, that won't take that extra step. But I think that everybody should be aware that you can tell how trusted the number of followers somebody has is by looking at that number. Now, what is the behindtheshot.tv numbers at?
93.1 for estimated real followers.
Lovely, lovely. Now, I have 14,000 followers on Instagram, and those are...
Yeah, you're way ahead of everything I own.
So I do think that the higher the number of followers you have, the higher percentage of fake accounts will be following you, just by virtue of the fake accounts have to follow real accounts organically, and they'll gravitate towards those of a mid-range followership. Although that's just me guessing. I'm just trying to figure out the system as everybody else is trying to do here. But Trey, I mean, I want to thank him for writing this book. But at the same time, I get everything I need from this book by reading the article and this conversation that we're having about it. And I'm sure that there's some salient details in there about how it has
influenced. Well, he actually goes into, my understanding, he was on This Week in Photo with Frederick Van Johnson a week or so before we were recording this. And I listened to a part of it. And he was discussing how pods work and, you know, Instagram pods, where you kind of boost each other.
Yep.
To help, naturally through group mindset, get followers. So there was a lot more in the discussion he did on TWIP that I'm assuming is in the book on how you can gain followers in a more legitimate way than buy them, things like that, but also how those systems are also gamed. My guess is it's got a lot more in it than that, but still it's fascinating to me that if you come up with a system, they will game it.
And what's fun for me is when I would post, when I was doing my Snowflake series, I would promote it. And in Instagram, just like on Facebook, you can target people based on their interests. And so I would choose anybody interested in meteorology, then this post will show up to them. So, I mean, how many people like specifically will be flagged as interested in meteorology of all things? Well, they better as hell be interested in snowflakes. And so there was a significant response. So if you can find, if your work has a niche and you can market towards that niche, then within Instagram's own constructs, you can start building a following that caters to that niche. And the more people that you have following something a little bit more obscure, that's far more valuable than having 10,000 followers, 20,000, 100,000 followers following you generically.
Agreed.
Yeah. So there you go. You can game the system. You can buy likes or, you know, comments or whatever from any platform, from social media, anywhere in the world. And this just puts a little bit of exposure on that. And I'm kind of glad for it. I do have a little bit of, I don't want to say distrust, but a bit of worry from the general public that will use this book as a way to say, oh, wow, I can get 200,000 followers with $200 and I'm just going to go do that and live the high life. Or you know what? I'm going to invest $1,000, have 1 million followers, and I'm going to just get drunk on my success because this book
but
is the ticket
to that
success. But to
an extent, that's happening anyway.
Yeah, but now this shows everybody how they can do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so all of these people with millions of illegitimate followers dwarfing my 14,000 legitimate followers, or however many you have, I think it hurts the platform in general. And Instagram needs to take a much more proactive step in preventing this from happening. And yeah, from 104,000 down to 80, well, that's a proactive step within weeks that they're trying to weed things out. But even still, less than 30 of them based on IG audit are classified as legitimate based on that algorithm. So work to be done to purify these streams. And I hope that that work is done post-haste.
Yep, I agree.
Okay, the final article today. This one I don't want to talk about necessarily verbatim. I always look for something a little bit more fun for the last topic. And F-Stoppers ran an article by Andy Day titled, Five Reasons Why You'll Never Earn Good Money as a Photographer. And I laugh at that because I make my career as a photographer. So I look at some of these headings, short-term commitment and maligning the momtographers, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, creatives in general. I mean, there's a reason why the term starving artist exists, right? Because being a creative, creating art or creating something visual, whether it be a photo, a painting, a sculpture, or music for that matter, most musicians never make it big, right? Even though they're fantastic, they just don't have the audience and the exposure to get that constant fandom that grows and grows. So Steve, I'm sure you read this article, and I know you have notes on it, but where do you fall on the current state of creative income? You know, as a creative person, how can you survive in today's economy?
Okay, so I have to say something totally unrelated to the story itself first.
Sure.
I looked up the author, like I do with every article. I looked up Andy Day. Andy, if you listen to this podcast, dude, I love your work. I love what this guy photographs. Seriously.
I'm just looking up his work right now, and it's just phenomenal.
He does these, and he does parkour type stuff. He photographs parkour type stuff.
He needs one of those lit flashes.
I'm telling you, I love his eye. I just had to get that out there. So the article itself. The title is clickbait to me.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Okay? I'm not saying that's a bad thing.
No, but
that's the world that we live in.
The world we live in, right? You know, just like...
Yeah, I mean, it's the world that we live in, and it's a valid title. Five reasons why you may never earn money as a photographer. And most of the reasons, I actually kind of agree with. His first reason is short-term commitment, right? Where in our parents' and our grandparents' day, they would stay at a career for 30 years and they'd get their gold watch or whatever. And today that doesn't happen. Most people jump from job to job and quite often from career to career, and they don't stick with it long enough to really get good at it. And I agree that that still exists to an extent. I do think that there are people out there, specifically in the arts, and this is where the argument, each one of these arguments obviously has pluses and minuses, right? One of the arguments against his reason number one, the short-term commitment thing is we're talking about the creative space. And I think there's a different thing between a normal worker that may go, you know, to work for a city or for a Fortune 500 company or for a mom and pop dry cleaner and end up changing careers multiple times, as opposed to a creative who tends to do something creative because they have no other choice within them but to do something creative. It's a different commitment level in the industry and in the area that we're in. So I think generically number one is right. I think on a more granular level, not necessarily.
Well, and you can think of it too as, what is a long-term commitment? I've met a number of photographers that say, you know what? I've been a photographer for 40 years, but they're an amateur photographer. So of those 40 years, how many hours have they spent being a photographer and potentially marketing themselves? I mean, it's not just short or long-term. It's the degree of the commitment. I mean, when I started down the path as becoming a professional photographer, I ate, slept, and breathed photography. I was working more than 100 hours a week, making very little money because I was still living with my mom at the time before my wife and I moved in together. And we had this whole time scale put out where if I could make a go of it while I still had very few bills to pay, then we can carry that forward and see how that plays out. And it was touch and go for a while. I mean, there's no question about it, as most artists would say.
Right.
And so that commitment, you have to have that like in your blood kind of desire to make this work.
Which tends to go with the arts.
It does. But it also can fade away if you're being just discouraged. If you have, there's more money doing more menial work and you just need to pay the bills, you're going to go and do that menial work because you need to eat.
Okay, but you just touched on something that's key. You said if you get discouraged. Now, I would argue that real passionate artists, musicians, there are amazing musicians. You brought up musicians earlier. There are amazing musicians and vocalists that are playing bars that are arguably better on every single level than some of the stars that are out there. They didn't get discouraged. Why? So the question has to be brought up, if you get discouraged, why? And that kind of leads, actually, again, Andy, you did a good job on the numbers here. It kind of leads into the number two, which is the, how did he word that?
Maligning the
momtographers.
Exactly.
Let me sum up what he means by that. It's the thing we hear all the time of, well, you know, every Tom, Dick, and Harry and Cindy around the block has an entry-level Canon, and they're saying, they're putting a shingle up saying that they will shoot senior portraits or weddings, and they do horrible, but they're willing to do a wedding for $600, and how do I compete with that? I cannot stress enough, if you're the person who says that, yeah, definitely change your career.
Yeah, because if you want to be competing with a $600 wedding photographer, then just stop right there. I mean,
well, you don't, okay, this is the one I'm passionate about, I apologize. You don't have to compete with everybody that's out there, right? I DJed weddings for 18 years and I heard everybody say, oh, well, they're charging 600 and I'm 1,000. Okay, so what? Every time in those 18 years that I raised my rates, panicking as I raised my rates, oh my gosh, I'm going to get less business. I usually got more business. I just got a different clientele. And the story I always like to tell is, and he won't listen to this, so he won't know I'm talking about him. A friend of mine owned a computer store. And he sold custom-built computers and he sold, you know, people would come in and trade one in and he'd refurb them and sell them. And I remember being in the store one day, waiting to talk to him, and he was waiting on a customer. And they said to him, yeah, I kind of like this one. How much is it? And he goes, it's $600. And they said, okay, I'll take it. I'm not even joking here. They literally said, okay, I'll take it. And he goes, you know what? I'll do it for $500.
What?
And I kind of went, idiot said what? But you just said that. The problem is the average business owner goes out of business because they may know their genre. They may know how to build a computer. They may know tech, but they don't know business or they don't know sales. Stop doing everything based on price. If you're more money than the momtographer, then your job is to educate the client while you solve their problem and while you are better than them, not just to lower your price to meet the $600. Tell them your value.
Steve, do you know what my formal education is?
My guess is that you were a hobo that jumped trains.
Very close. I was in advertising.
Were you really?
Yeah. Yeah, my formal education is advertising and marketing. And
interesting.
Prior to that, I flunked out of a degree program for computer science and computer programming software development, which I realized was not as creative as I had intended. But the concept of advertising is persuasion. It's being able to influence people, being able to talk to people in an understanding way, being able to even do subliminally. And I don't know if you caught what I just did, Steve. I scratched my head twice and then you scratched your head. So, you know, subliminal messaging can work in some really wonderful
Stop
ways.
Stop messing with my mind, man.
So, you know, the idea of being able to understand a client and being able to relay the importance of what you are, to market yourself. I mean, if you're a photographer or a creative person in any way, you're typically a one-man shop. You're an entrepreneur. You're a small business owner, and you need the skills of a small business owner and an entrepreneur in order to be success. Your art will always be great so long as you're passionate about it and you continue to put in the effort for it. But carry that forward to making money with it, and it's an entirely different skill set.
Yeah, we're on the same page. He had 5 points in here, and
I love number three because I get tax breaks on everything that I buy because I can write it off to my corporation.
And that's one of the ones that I listened to and went, that's not a reason why you won't be successful.
Well, maybe it's because you're spending all of your money on new equipment and but in my early days, I was reinvesting every dollar spent because I could. You know, I ended up, I've got this much money. Let's buy a large format printer and let's learn that craft because I need to sell prints, especially at art shows. And let's see if that works for me. If I know that I need this kind of equipment, when I did a gig for Discovery Channel, I had to spend about 50% of what they were paying me on the equipment required to get their shot list complete. So that Right. immediately cuts down my profits on that considerably. But now I have that equipment that can be a tax write-off. But at the same time, it lets me explore other concepts for other companies using that same equipment. And I've used it countless times since then.
Instead of having gear acquisition syndrome and just buying gear, This comes to the business sense that we talked about with the money thing and understanding how to quote your prices. Letting a client buy you the gear that you not only need for that shoot, but can use down the road. Understanding actually what your tax rate is.
Yeah.
So there's a ton of business owners out there that don't understand. You may be in a 45% tax bracket and your friends are going to look at you and say, well, you can't be in a 45% tax bracket. You need a better accountant. Well, no, that's not how it works. If your income level is 30%, now granted, that's probably not what you're paying with your deductions, but if your income level lands you at a 30% income tax bracket, but in the US at least, your employer normally pays half of your Social Security and the employee pays half of the Social Security, which is just under 15%. If you're the employer, you pay both.
Yep.
So you're paying off the net, off your top number, you're paying 15% to Social Security. Then you go back to that top number and calculate your 30% tax bracket. Yeah, you have to understand your numbers and understand you're not a hobbyist. You're a small business owner.
Yeah. And a few years ago, I incorporated. So that changes things. The corporation is in a lower tax bracket, and then I pay myself a salary. And so all the tax deductions and everything that is handled by the corporation. And that I didn't do for years until I realized it made financial sense to do so. Again, going back to those business reasons. Let's go into the next option or the next heading here.
Oh, this was funny.
The capitalist con of the creative industries. Describe this to me in summary.
So he references in here enslavement to the neoliberal regime. And as I read it, I thought, okay, well, he's a good writer. He's putting big words in there that sound like they have a lot of meaning. Capitalism is the ruthless regime. It wants to extract as much value from you as possible. Okay. This is one I take issue with slightly. He's not wrong. Well, it's just this is not new, right? Companies have always tried. There's a reason that we have labor unions. Companies have always tried to get labor and services as cheap as possible to maximize their profit. That's what business owners tend to try and do, sometimes to an extreme that's not fair to the employees. I don't see that necessarily as a reason to not be successful as a photographer or make money as a photographer. Again, as long as you understand what your business is. He talks in here about the percentage, 90% have worked for free, right? 18% earn less than $20,000 a year. 25% earn less than $6,500 a year. Okay. In creative industries, sometimes you're going to work for free. Now,
I think that 90% is too low a number. I think every photographer, every artist at some point.
Every creative has worked for free.
Yeah.
Every. And, you know, we all post the jokes and the comments about, you know, exposure doesn't pay your bills and stop working for free and start charging. Okay. There are always times you might look at a charitable organization, decide to work for free. You might look at somebody that it's like, you know what? Working for free is not going to get me more work for them, but it's going to build my network and have advantages to me down the road. Working for free might be my version of being an intern with this company to learn things I can take with me. You know, this idea of working for free is bad is true. This idea of never work for free is not true. There are right. Do what works for your work model. 18% earning less than $20,000 and 25% earning less than $6,500. My argument would be
that's not a full-time job then. You've got work on the side. You can't live on $6,500 a year, so something else is taking up a lot of your time, right?
Well, I'm going to quote him here. Earnings are incredibly low because we want to feel authentic and autonomous in our work. Okay, first of all, most of what you're talking about in the creative space, especially today, are young people, right? These are young adults just starting out. Most of them would probably barely be making $20,000 a year anyway. If they're a creative, they also may not have a college degree. So, and they're self-employed starting out. Historically, we're gonna make less, work more, work for free, and try and build our name. That is not an indication in any manner, shape, or form that this industry is dead.
No,
it's an indication that we need to educate them.
A dollar value being so low, I mean, you're not just building up money, you're building up brand equity, right? Your name is your brand, your reputation is your brand, and brand equity is what lets you get bigger clients as time goes on, which then brings me into point number five. It's nice to be nice. And you know what? You want to leave a good impression with people. And I always want to – people ask me, oh, well, can I have a discount on – like when I do an art show, I say, well, is there any wiggle room on the price? Well, no. It's artwork. Somebody else has bought this before at this price. It's unfair to them. I'm not going to lower the price on this. But I don't want to be a jerk about it. I mean, I just – the value is what the value is. But can there be a value add? Can I give them something extra for free? Something small, you know, maybe it's a book, a pack of greeting cards, a very small print or something that my material cost is quite low on. Just something that doesn't devalue the artwork itself, but if they want something extra, then I can add that on. And so, yeah, it's nice to be nice, but do so in a way that does not make your work look like it is bargainable or negotiable in terms of its price.
And that's really the point of his number five is people want to be nice instead of charging good rates. But the reason, and by the way, this is not just creatives, right? This is every industry. Almost everybody, even if you're the buyer, not the seller, almost everybody hates going to buy a car. Almost everybody hates going to deal with buying a house because we don't like to negotiate pricing for anything. We're not comfortable negotiating pricing. And if we're the business side, we always have that question of, am I charging the right rate? Am I too high? Am I too low? They seem to be hemming and hawing. Should I lower my rate? You have to know what your cost of doing business is. You have to be a business person, and you have to decide what rate you're going to charge. And then, you know, what you said about what can you do as a one percenter, as an add-on, you know, would you like fries with that? That's your marketing background. But a lot of people don't realize that. A lot of people don't realize you could say, you know what? I'll tell you what. If you buy this print, I'll give you a 5x7 for free of this other print. And it's not going to cost me a lot, but it's going to close the sale. This, again, is the reason. What is the number? 90% of businesses go under?
Yeah, something like that in their first few years.
Because they don't, they know their niche. They know their work. They don't know business.
The image that I have behind me that we were talking about at the top of the podcast, Steve, when I sell that at an art show, I describe to people the way that the image was taken. And then I show them on my phone the behind-the-scenes image that we also discussed on your episode of Behind the Shot.
We have it on that show, yeah.
And I tell them, you know, if you would like to take this home, I will give you a 5x7 of the behind-the-scenes photograph that you can take home and use that as a conversation piece to really show people how real and magical this is at the same time. And that seals the deal. I mean, what's the cost on me is a couple of cents, but the value to them as a customer is immense. And then it translates into them not just buying the art, they're buying the artist. And you always have to keep that in mind. If people are putting value in you, part of that value is in the product that you're producing, sure. But a good chunk of that is in you, your brand, and your reputation, and you cannot devalue that.
And wouldn't you argue that that actually is a better goal? I don't want them to buy a print. I want them to buy the brand. I want them to become a Don Komarecz collector.
And I have a number of people that come back to me at that same art show every year, and they might not buy something big every year. They might walk away with something small, but they come back every year and they buy something. And, or, you know, a lot of people will walk by and just say hi and start talking about stuff. And actually, I mean, they might be friends from the camera club or something like that, but, they'll start talking to people that are there just browsing my work and just kind of lean in and say, oh, take a look at this shot. This guy does amazing work, and start talking and promoting me on my behalf without those words coming out of my mouth. And that is the best kind of promotional material you could ever hope for. So you have to cultivate this audience, and it doesn't come by going to those bargain basement prices. It comes by building up that brand equity. And if you want to be a creative professional, I encourage anybody listening to this, find a marketing or advertising course, a public speaking course, something that could help you communicate to people in a way that gets your ideas across, that helps you, benefits you, but doesn't make the other person feel like they're getting any less value for the deal.
I completely agree with you. And before we close this story, I just have to say one thing. Andy Day, I love your work. And for people who are wondering, it's andyday.com. I've got to give this guy a plug because really, honestly, he's the type of photography I dig.
And he's in Paris, France. So he might have been front and center to the Notre Dame stuff. And what a tragedy that was. And hopefully he was out documenting some of the response, because the people crying in the streets. And as I don't like that to ever happen, that's the kind of emotion and atmosphere that we as photographers need to be able to share with the world. And a passionate photographer like Andy would hopefully be able to do that, or at least his passions extend to so many other emotional and energetic images. All right, Steve, let's get into our picks of the week here before we go on too long. I'm going to go first because this one, I needed a cheap lens. I needed a 200 millimeter lens as cheap as I could get. And why did I need that? Well, okay, so let's dial this back a little bit. Every year I participate in a photographic competition called the Nikon Small World Competition. It's open to anybody, Nikon or otherwise. Typically, they get people from scientific backgrounds, but if you can take a photograph of something really small and sciencey and interesting, then you can submit it to this particular contest. However, I've never won anything, and I've submitted multiple years. And yeah, you know what? There's a lot of people submitting stuff. Who knows? But it turns out, and I've just learned this now, that any image that is submitted that was not photographed using a microscope objective will be immediately disqualified. And so a lot of the work that I've done using that Canon MPE 65 millimeter lens that I love so much can get up to a 5:1 magnification. I can add extension tubes and extra optics to get that up to 12:1 magnification, but a microscope objective it is not, at least not in an official context for the rules of this particular context. It's semantics, I know, but it's not my rules to change. It's theirs.
Right.
And so in the past, I had worked with a 20 times microscope objective to do some very close-up snowflake work. And I know that it went through multiple rounds of judging. It ultimately didn't get selected, and that's fine. But none of my other work made it. And so I got to thinking, how can I get my work to be approved by this contest? Well, a lot of the microscope objectives that I use are called infinity-corrected objectives, which means you have to mount them on a lens, a pre-existing lens set to infinity. And the Michutoyo lenses that I use, and I'll put a link to what I prefer in the show notes, and they're found easily on eBay, have a 200 millimeter focal length requirement for its buddy lens, its tube lens, that sits on the camera and that it sits on top of that. So I found a 200 millimeter lens for $20. And so I went back to the Canon FD mount. This is the Canon FD 200 millimeter lens, F4. And I'm sure that on its own, it's not really great optics. I mean, clearly there's no autofocus or any, it's just a purely mechanical lens of that vintage. But it's a 200 millimeter tube. And if I pull up my eBay purchase history, because I bought this just recently, I paid US $19.99 for it. I actually paid $25 shipping to have it shipped from Asia to me. So I paid more for shipping than the lens. And I bought, a lot of people might not realize, if you're thinking about microscopes, you're thinking about high magnification. Michutoyo makes objectives from like 200 times magnification down to 1 times magnification. Now, the least expensive of them is the 2x magnification objective, which I paid. It's used, it's beaten up on the outside, but the optics are clean. I paid $260 US for this objective. So all in, before the shipping costs, I'm still under $300 to get a 2x microscope objective optic that I could then mount onto my camera. I'd need to buy a little adapter. Michutoyo lenses have a 26 millimeter filter thread. So I had to buy an M26 through to whatever the filter thread size is on this lens. And that just couples it all together. And then you've got a macro lens that costs you less than $300, gets you more than 1:1 magnification. The depth of field is minuscule at best. And there are iris diaphragms that you can build into a system like this that you can slow that down a little bit. You can get kind of complex if you want to and sacrifice resolution for depth of field. But the point is, for less than $300, you can get to some extreme magnifications, and you could have some fun and enter these contests. So the last week, I have been shooting footage, both stills and video, with this $20 tube lens with a microscope objective on it, just because I needed to meet with the rules and regulations of this particular contest. So I've been jumping.
What are you shooting video of at that?
What's that?
What are you shooting video of at that magnification?
Well, I shot pollen being emitted from the ovaries of a flower. I don't know if ovary is the right word for that particular part of the plant. A water droplet evaporating on a butterfly wing, so that it was like acting like a lens, magnifying the butterfly wing, but then it shrinks down to this little tiny shriveled up because it wasn't pure water. There was impurities, and so that remains at the end of it. I want to do some cross polarization of crystals forming, some like vitamin C, which is ascorbic acid, which has some crazy psychedelic colors that you can create. I got tons of ideas, Steve. You know I have ideas.
Wow.
this is the kind of stuff that on a small scale, and the contest has, if anybody wants to join or submit something to this particular contest, you're running out of time. The deadline is the end of April, but the prize money is good. $3,000 for the first place, $2,000 for the second, and $1,000 for the third. And that they have those same prize numbers for both the stills and the video. So if you wanted to do stills and video, you could submit to both. And I know that they receive fewer video submissions than they do stills. So I'm hoping.
What's the entry fee?
There's no entry fee.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. No entry fee for this. So, but again, you have to have a microscope objective mounted to your camera in order to qualify for this competition. One can be had for under $300 used on eBay. This is a really high quality one. It is their APO, their planned APO objective that has a long working distance. But I'm sure if you type in microscope objective into eBay, you could probably get something in the double digit dollars without question. Quality, well, maybe it's not there, but at least it gives you the requirements to enter the competition, but you need that lens to attach to it. And so far right. in my studies, if you don't have a lens already in your arsenal that covers the 200 millimeter range and you need something, the Canon new FD 200 millimeter F4 lens, plus I've got the adapters to fit it onto my modern cameras. Of course, that's a couple of bucks, but it seems to be performing well. So that is my pick.
Nice. I like it.
And what do you have for us?
So, I debate between two or three of them. And this one, I've already mentioned it, so I'm going to pick it again. I do not own this product, but when they first released it, it just looked really, really intriguing to me. And then Colin Smith of Photoshop Cafe was on the floor at NAB, and he did a video testing it, and the results were shockingly good. So, it's made by the company Rode, who does a lot of different video microphones and lavalier microphones, and they do the Rode Podcaster now. They do a number of different audio type products. It's called the Rode Wireless Go. It's a new announcement. It's $199 US. And basically what it is, this is good for those of you that do video stuff and need good audio. So many people struggle with using a boom mic or something on their DSLR to record video. And the sound is okay. It's not always great. What this basically is a wireless transmitter pack. So you have a receiver that stays with the camera that uses an 1/8-inch plug out of the receiver and goes into the audio input in the camera or whatever your device might be. It could be a Zoom H4n or a Zoom H6 or something like that. And then it has the transmitter. Now, normally when you think about a wireless microphone like a lavalier mic, it's a belt transmitter that has a wire plugged into it that goes up under your shirt and clips on your collar to give you a lavalier mic.
That's what I've always worn.
This one has that ability. It does have an 1/8-inch jack, so you could clip it on your belt. You could plug any normal lavalier mic into it and use it that way. But on the top of the little pack, which is very, very tiny, it has a built-in microphone.
Oh, so...
So you can actually take this transmitter, quote-unquote, for lack of a better phrase, belt pack... And just clip it on your shirt directly.
Now, it's going to look a little silly because it's big and bulky, right?
It's shockingly small. And, I mean, it'll fit in the palm of your hand.
Okay.
But here's the thing. Yes, it's a square, but it has a, you know, spring-loaded belt clip. So what you do is you put the big square inside the shirt.
Oh, there you go.
So that all you see is the belt clip, which then says Rode on it. It's not tiny. But if you're walking around and you want to interview somebody very quickly, the first thought that hit me was a Zoom H6 with two of these. So that you just like when I was at WPPI, I had my Zoom H6 on a belt clip. So I just walked around. The Zoom was on. It was actually a spider holster clip. And I hung it on my spider holster and I had a microphone cord coming off of it. Well, I could have two receivers plugged into that Zoom Velcroed to it. And in my pocket, I could just have two of these mic transmitters. And I walk up to the person I'm interviewing, clip one on their shirt, clip one on mine, done. Colin also said that there are people that have tested them using it as a little teeny handheld microphone and just going back and forth their mouth, the other person's mouth.
And that works.
But the sound on this thing, it's $200. And the sound was fantastic. I'm buying one.
Well, and I know you're something of an audiophile with your background in music and radio broadcasting. So to have your recommendation on something like this, I might look at one as well.
Yeah, it's again $199, a Rode Wireless Go, and it's Rode RODE. And actually, the website is rode.com/wirelessgo. But it's an intriguing product. I haven't played with it myself. It ships at the end of this month or any day now, actually. But man, it looks interesting.
Now, could the receiver will only receive from one transmitter, right? Like it's a one-to-one relationship.
Yeah, you pair them.
Right.
So there's a button sequence you go through to pair them.
Right. I mean, it would be great if you could have, like you mentioned, passing the microphone back and forth between people, if you could pair two of them to the same receiver and have that go in as separate channels or even as mono to the input on whatever camera device that you have. But like you mentioned with your Zoom H6, there's other solutions for that too, where you can connect up two sets of them and funnel that into whatever you need. It gets complex at that point. I was just hoping for something a bit more simplistic.
Yeah. And they're, it's 2.4 gigahertz, as far as frequency is concerned. So you could end up with interference on him. But I'll tell you, he walked across the floor at WPPI and I was shocked. And he even said, as he was doing it, Colin, he said, I can't hear this obviously now. I'm testing it. I won't know till I get home, but you're hearing it. And he told me today, I talked to him today, and when he got home, he was like, oh my gosh, I need to own this. It sounds good. Go look up the video.
I will.
Cafe.com.
All right. Well, yeah. Make sure that you can send me the link to that. So I put it in the show notes, which kind of puts the proof in the pudding for your recommendation. It's a great
thing,
Steve. Thank you. All right. That brings us to the end of another episode of Photo Geek Weekly. We've already mentioned earlier on, Steve, where people can find you, but let's reiterate that. Your podcast is Behind the Shot at behindtheshot.tv, correct?
That is correct. Behindtheshot.tv. I've been doing the podcast for a number of years, almost a year now on my own. And so there's a full back catalog there at the website. You can find me online as far as social media is concerned. Instagram, it's Behind the Shot TV. Twitter, it's Behind the Shot TV. Or you can look me up personally, Steve Brazel, on Twitter or Instagram. It's the same as the country of Brazil, but two L's. And then in Facebook, it's Steve Brazel Photography for me. The podcast is Behind the Shot Podcast. I got to remember these in my head now. And hit me up anywhere.
All right. Well, do that. And we'll have the links to all of that in the show notes over at photogeekweekly.com, where you'll find the links to all of the stories and everything that we talked about here, including the pics of the week. And personally, you can find me at donkom.ca, donkom.ca. And if you're listening to this still at this point, please consider some of the workshops that I have ongoing. You know, the Iceland workshop will only run if I can sell out the remaining seats. And I think there's 5 seats left. It's in October of this year, so we still have time. But if you're hemming and hawing on that, grab on board right now and make sure that the workshop is a go. It would be great to be, hanging out with any of you guys listening across the beautiful fjords of Iceland through the waterfalls and the glaciers and just the beauty up there. And I'm not going to be taking many pictures myself. I'm there to educate and instruct everybody else to make sure everybody gets the images of a lifetime. And that's at doncom.ca/workshops. And you can find all of my contact information there, including my phone number. I get people calling me out of the blue sometimes and they wonder why I put my phone number in the public. Because, well, I don't get enough phone calls for it to be annoying. So if you have something salient to call me about, I don't mind that either. But if you call me with gibberish, then I might pull that number down. But for now, it's there. Always happy to answer my phone. Thank you for listening to this episode. And with all of that said, it's time to get out and shoot.